from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. There are now 1,700 technology companies based in San Francisco, a 30% jump from just 2 years ago. And the tech boom has kept the unemployment rate well under the state average, and it's brought a lot of tax revenue to the city, but has it come at a cost? Critics say the trend and its accompanying high rents is shutting out artists and the middle class and threatening the very soul of the city. San Francisco has long been embroiled in gentrification fights, but how will it withstand the newest, biggest tech boom? We'll take it up in the hour ahead, and you're invited after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Salon.com founder and former CEO and editor-at-large David Talbot, author of Season of the Witch, published an article in the September 20th issue of San Francisco Magazine, which you can find on our website, by the way, at kqed.org/forum. And the article is under the title asking the question, how much tech can one city take? And that core question, David Talbot asks as he unfurls his journalistic take on San Francisco, as it's undergoing a transformation to becoming more at one with Silicon Valley, and all such a transformation may imply, including higher rents and housing costs and a greater tax base and a digital divide among San Francisco residents. To put it into another question, which David Talbot also poses in his article about his hometown city by the bay, do we wish to be a city of enlightenment or a city of apps? We take that up in this forum hour. And David Talbot, good to see you again. Welcome.
Hi, Michael.
Well, does it come down to that either or, a city of enlightenment or a city of apps? Is that pretty much the divide?
Well, I think so. I think San Francisco in many ways is becoming a tale of two cities these days. You have a city of a technological elite, more and more companies like Twitter and Zynga setting up shop here, which is good for the city in many ways. And I'm not anti-technological progress by any means. I'm not a neo-Luddite. So you have a lot of new jobs. You have a growing tax base. You have a lot of new prosperity. But on the other hand, you have a lot of people who are left out of this new digital gold rush. And it's more and more difficult for these people to find a hold in the city, to find affordable housing, to find jobs that they can fit into. So we're looking at two different cities and a growing divide between those cities.
Well, we went through this once before in San Francisco. I mean, it's almost redone. At this point, isn't it?
I'm having flashbacks every day now because, of course, I was part of that first dot-com boom back in the 90s with Salon, the web magazine I founded in 1995. And so, look, I'm very torn about this. You know, I do see that technology is a liberating force. I was, stuck in a dead-end newspaper job back in the mid-90s. The newspaper industry was slowly dying. You know, the web represented to me the future and represented possibilities. So I took my little crew, we jumped ship, we started Salon, and I needed engineers. I needed the techies. I needed the geeks. They helped me liberate myself from the old dying newsprint world. And so there's great possibilities in the new technological revolution, too. I'm a big fan of social media, Facebook. I'm on Facebook. I like Twitter. And these people are revolutionaries, many of them at heart. And yet, along with any boom like this, there's greed. There's greed and there's selfishness. There's a libertarian stinginess in the digital culture. And I think what we need to do is two things. One is start asking the city to start intervening in this process more and more, the city government, to bridge the gap between the haves and have-nots in the digital revolution. And we have to ask the new people of wealth to also start thinking about not just themselves and their companies and their stockholders, but the city.
Well, Mayor Lee has certainly been supporting this. I mean, you talk about those Tuesday afternoons that he meets with techies, and Aaron Peskin, as you point out in the article, said Ron Conway's essentially trying to buy this mayor the way the Koch brothers may be trying to buy a presidency. I mean, there's a lot of action from City Hall, and the action has been largely, tax breaks for Twitter and tax breaks for other companies that are moving into San Francisco, and it seems partial to many. At the same time, it's building up the tax base, so it's a kind of blessing and curse, maybe. And How do you think about this present administration? I mean, in terms of doing the kind of action or proactive sorts of things that you're suggesting they should be doing?
Well, Ed Lee, the mayor, plays a big role in my article in San Francisco Magazine, because I think he's a walking embodiment of these contradictions. On the one hand, Ed has roots in that progressive, you know, San Francisco. He was raised in a very modest family in Seattle. His father was a cook in a Chinese restaurant. He himself was a young legal crusader at the beginning of his
civil
career.
Rights lawyer.
That's right. He blocked other young lawyers he'd gone to school with from evicting poor tenants in Chinatown. He was a fighter. He was a street fighter, crusader. He called it class struggle, what he was doing in his early days. But now as mayor of this city, he's decided that for the good of the city, he's aligning himself more and more with his technological elite. Now, he does pressure these guys. As I said earlier, he's going to them, to, you know, the heads of these companies, and saying, look, think not just of yourself, but of the city as a whole. Give back, like the Warren Hellman did, like the Bill Grahams did, like Shorenstein family, the Haas family. There's a great tradition here of wealthy people giving back to the city, and we see their largesse and their generosity all around us in the museums, in Golden Gate Park, and in this Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival in Golden Gate Park that Warren Hellman funded and is even funding to this day from beyond the grave, bless Warren's heart. But we don't see much of that generosity, at least in the city, from this new digital elite, these
younger
people.
The city's
people.
Become Silicon Valley, as you point out. It's like the two have become blended.
We're a bedroom community now, a commuter community for Silicon Valley. I mean, everyone sees these big tour buses gliding through their neighborhoods now, picking up the workers from Noe Valley and from Glen Park and Bernal Heights and taking them down 101 to Google and the other companies.
Even when they don't go to 101, if they're on Twitter in some of these places, there's food provided for them, so they're not, as you point out in your article, going to the cafes or the restaurants. They're not necessarily spending money in San Francisco. But other than those kind of effects and the fact that housing has obviously been affected, higher costs, what are the real social and cultural effects of this whole boom?
Well, you know, I look at some of this historically because I wrote this book, Season of the Witch. I was on your show a few months ago talking about it. It was the history of San
Terrific
Francisco.
Book, by the way. Yeah.
Thank you. History of the city in those volcanic years between 1967 and 1982, when San Francisco values were born in blood and strife and struggle. I don't think this new generation tends to know the history of this wonderful city that's attracted them, why it is such a beautiful, charming oasis. It took struggle to get there. And what they're attracted to here, the diversity, the social diversity, the progressive consciousness, the arts, all of that is now being threatened because of the rising cost of living here, because of the rising real estate prices. And everything that attracted these young digital workers to the city is in peril. And so I think they have to have a historical sense of how you build a great city. And, earlier waves of immigrants to the city, there was just as much controversy. When the hippies, of course, invaded San Francisco in the 1960s, the counterculture wave, people freaked out the same way. They were ruining the city. They were destroying it. It was the barbarians.
Happened after that with the gay wave, too.
The gay wave. And that was similar in some ways because they blamed them, of course, for gentrifying poorer neighborhoods. There was a lot of violence against gays in those contested neighborhoods.
And there was even violence during that gentrification period that we were talking about, is that first digital divide when the boom happened. There was destruction to some. There's a Mercedes in the Mission, you know, let's destroy it type of thing.
Key those cars,
exactly.
Scratch them. But, you know, what those waves of immigrants to San Francisco left behind was a great cultural legacy. I mean, think of the music that hippie generation produced. Jefferson Airplane, Grateful Dead, Janis Joplin. Think of what gays have done for the city in politics and the arts and food. It's an open question what this new technological, you know, elite is going to leave behind.
Well, like you said, there's a kind of libertarian stinginess, and there's also a very different ethos in terms of philanthropy or, you know, giving back. I wonder, though, with the exception, for example, I think you point out in your article, somebody like Mark Bainhoff, who gave $100 million for a hospital in Mission Bay, there's not a lot of giving. But there seems to be a whole different notion of what giving ought to amount to. I mean, literally amount to. That is, let's see if we can measure this metrically. It's that sort of thing. Or there's a young fellow whom I'm sure you know who heads up the Tipping Point. And, you know, there's a lot of money being given to that organization to help the poor. But yes. The money is not necessarily going, into the arts or going into culture.
That's right, or the parks or the schools or the museums or things that people tend to touch and feel in the city. Look, I'm not denigrating those who are giving in a quiet way, and maybe they're under my radar, and I didn't even pick up on what's happening below the surface. But in terms of what's visible in the city, in the life of a city, you know, you can feel that in certain cities when you walk around, the generations of wealth that have given back to their cities. And we certainly feel this in San Francisco. I mentioned all those people earlier, the Hellmans, the Bill Grahams, the Haas family. And, you know, it's not just the plaques on the buildings that they've contributed to, the museums and so forth. It's the life of the city. They make the city more livable. And so this generation that's now benefiting so much from this great capital of conscious and progressive consciousness has to start thinking about what's good for the city. I mentioned Dave Eggers as a great example to this younger generation because he's a younger guy than I am. And Dave's doing something I think really terrific, which I hope we can talk about in a minute or so.
Well, he's looking for a building over on Market Street. He's going to have artisans and craftspeople in that building. And Dave is a visionary, but you've got younger people here who are so entrenched in the tech world, I think you're suggesting, that they don't necessarily get out of it. Let me actually invite listeners to join this conversation because I know that many of you would probably like to weigh in. This is a topic that not only in San Francisco but throughout the Bay Area has a great deal of importance to it because we're really talking about the future of a place that has been known for its funkiness and its artistic qualities and its bohemianism for many years now. And you know, there are places that are already closing down. You look at Tosca and the Lumiere Theater and Rico's. It's already going through. Fior d'Italia already going through changes that may be accruing because of what we're talking about here. If you'd like to join the conversation, you're certainly cordially invited to do that. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. So feel free to weigh in here. Do you see this kind of tension on an everyday basis? And how much do you think it's perhaps changing the soul, to use that word again, as David Talbot uses it in his article, which, again, you can read on our website by going to kqed.org/forum. Join us here, toll free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Post any questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page, or you can, of course, tweet us, and our handle is @kqedforum. There's a real difficulty, not only with housing, we're talking about the soul of the city and all these kinds of things, but with what's really become a class divide.
Absolutely. You know, there's an elite now, more and more, this growing tech elite, and there's the service class that serves them, basically. So
just having a hard time affording living here.
And those people can't afford to live here, the school teachers, the people who work in the restaurants, who are serving this wealthy elite. You know, it's been a boon for restaurants, of course, in San Francisco, all this new wealth. But then you find the chefs that are creating this wonderful magic every night have to live right across the bay. I interviewed an employee of the public school system. A woman who works as a librarian for the public schools, has lived here most of her adult life with her partner. She's a lesbian. She's part of the lesbian settlement that moved into Bernal Heights in the 80s. And she and her partner now have kids, and they've bid on 5 houses in the last year. And every time they bid on a house, someone swoops in at the last minute and puts up $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 more in cash. And she's saying, who are these people? And she says, I have nothing against tech. I'm an early adopter. I have my iPhone. I have my iPad. We love it. But who do these people expect are going to teach their children? And who's going to take care of them in the hospital if no one lives in the city other than the tech elite? And, of course, the people who are really below the poverty line and living 2 or 3 families in a house.
But the other side of that, as you pointed out, is you got a 30% higher job rate in the last couple of years. San Francisco's really much better unemployment rate than the rest of California, greater tax base, $6 billion over the last year.
That's right. San Francisco is benefiting. There's no doubt about it. And Dave Eggers said to me when I interviewed him, and Dave has an open mind about the technological progress, although he wants this building, as you said earlier, to be filled with people who work with their hands, making skateboards and bicycles and clocks so young people can see, hey, it's not all just digital these days. There are real things. But, what we need, I think, is those two worlds to come together. And when you look at the mid-market area where Dave wants to move in and take over a building, with Twitter now being the big, gorilla in that area, of course, it was a ravaged area, a lot of homelessness on the streets, drugs, drugs and so on. It was a good thing in some ways for that, you know, company to go in there. And yet they're kind of cocooned up there on the top floors of that building. They everything they need, those workers are served to them. They have great lunches and meals prepared for them. They never have to leave the building. They're actually picked up by private shuttle buses if they commute into the city and taken to the city, so they never even have to ride on the Muni with the rest
of
us.
Well, it's like Google, too. They can have their dry cleaning done there. They can bring their dogs there. I mean, they never have to leave if they don't want to.
Exactly.
More work
so it's kind of a Blade Runner kind of society we're talking about here with this elite, you know, at the top, you know, 10, 12 floors up, and the rest of us down on the scruffy streets below.
How about the November ballot? They're going to there's a proposal to shift the business taxes from a payroll-based plan to one that's essentially based on gross receipts. It's all a part of what we're talking about here, too. I mean, that's proposed by the mayor.
That's right. And the mayor and his, you know, his kind of tech main advisor and backer supporter, Ron Conway, who's become a major force in city politics. And, you know, look, again, I hired over 300 people when I ran Salon over the years there. I believe that actually, you know, you shouldn't be penalized for hiring people. So I actually endorse that shift in tax policy. I think we want to encourage people to hire people and more people. But, you know, what we need is more of what the mayor's also doing, setting up a housing trust fund to help middle-class families buy houses and hold on to houses in this city. It's a very small program. It's too small, but we need to think about expanding programs like that.
David Talbot's with us in studio, author of Season of the Witch, but also an article appeared in San Francisco Magazine, How Much Tech Can One City Take? And we thought we'd bring Jim Wunderman into this, president and CEO of the Bay Area Council, a regional business-sponsored public policy group. Jim, you've been listening?
Yeah, I have.
Okay. Do we need to save San Francisco here? Is that what's at stake?
Oh, I don't think we need to save it. It seems like for all the reasons David's explaining, it's doing a pretty good job on its own. You know, I'd say San Francisco is probably the envy of California, and cities around the state and around the country just wish they had the problems that San Francisco is facing. So, you know, these are really good times in the city, and they bring, as David points out, they do bring challenges, and those are challenges that do need to be addressed by the government and the community.
Those challenges, and by the way, I should mention that the Bay Area Council is located in San Francisco, those challenges have to do with, low-income housing and income disparities, those sorts of things mainly?
Yeah, and they're not new problems. They're just exacerbated when times get good. So, you know, over the last bunch of years, the people who struggled, who are currently struggling to get a bid accepted on a house, had all the opportunity in the world to do it, assuming they had the same job that they have now, but now they're starting to get shut out. So, you know, San Francisco, probably about the same size as Paris, but we have 800,000 people, and Paris has 3 million. So we've chosen to be a lower density place with some changes happening there. There's certainly plenty of room in the city to have more housing for people of all income levels. And if you've got the wealth to support it being driven by this tech movement, then you should be able to figure out ways to help people at various levels of income stay in the city or live close to the city and so forth.
Well, the tech movement is driving people out, though. That's pretty clear at this point. And I guess you get into the question of how much should it be allowed to continue to build its momentum and maybe drive more people out before something can be done to remedy.
Well, I would strongly urge we not bar the door, that we, in fact, encourage the growth of these businesses, which are, frankly, as David points out, they're quite consistent with the culture of San Francisco. I agree that a lot of the folks probably showing up here don't know the history of the city, but they didn't come here blindly. They, you know, as he points out in the article, they come here to choose this lifestyle. They want to bike to work. They want to be able to go to cafes. They like the culture of openness and diversity, and you know they're inherently progressive. And so you know they're self-selecting San Francisco. So these kinds of companies in this environment are winning the global battle for talent, and that's a very, very good thing. The issue then becomes, okay, what about the folks who are here and you know not doing as well and sort of doing those service jobs, if you will, to support them, and you know that's a challenge. But I think those are the kinds of challenges that can be addressed a lot better when the economy is strong. When the economy is weak, it's really hard to find the resources necessary to address social issues like that.
Well, do you also find, as David points out in this article and as he's pointed out here this morning, that there's less of a willingness, and maybe it's something cultural or geeky, I don't know, to give back and to contribute to civic as well as artistic and cultural institutions that need money from some of these masters of the universe and could use help from them big time?
I teach a class at UC Davis at the Graduate School of Management, and I have some of these types of students in the class, and they're itching to give back in their lives, and they want their jobs to be meaningful in that way. I don't know that we've necessarily shown them all of the appropriate paths, but they're very smart, and I think with a little bit of support and maybe time added in, that you're going to see perhaps a slightly different type of philanthropy, but very valuable philanthropy nonetheless in the future. You know, these folks care about the situation here. They care about the world. They're not immune to messages that, you know, what they do affects people around them. So I think it is a challenge, and may have to do with age. But as time moves forward, that San Francisco could be in a great position to rear a new generation of very important people who care about the society, perhaps in different ways, and frankly are able to deliver solutions that their predecessors weren't able to do.
You were going to say something here,
yeah,
David.
Yeah, I was just going to respond, and I think Jim's making some good points, and I agree with a lot of what he's saying. But, you know, there is, I think, this kind of entrepreneurial consciousness, and I get it. I was an entrepreneur myself, starting a salon. But I heard a recent story, and it's not necessarily a social consciousness. A recent story, here's a very successful executive, moves to the city recently to work for one of the big companies, has a family, checks out the public school system in San Francisco, wants to work with it, wants to, like, help improve, use his money, his skills, to get in there, and tries to do that, is frustrated by the bureaucracy. We all know public education, you know, everywhere in every city is loaded with bureaucracy, teachers, unions, the government, and so on. Gets frustrated, bails out, and decides to start instead his own private school for his kids and their family friends. He secedes, in other words, from the public San Francisco. That, to me, is kind of the nut of the problem, because that again, someone with a deeper social commitment would say, okay, I'm going to ride this out. I'm going to keep struggling with the public schools, again, like, you know, many people like Dave Eggers, who's a cultural entrepreneur who has his own operation, but he goes into the public schools as well. And look, that's where the last stand for, in some ways, for America, of democracy and of the city, where we all can come together and improve things. I would love to see this new entrepreneurial elite focus on the public school system in the city, work with the teachers' unions, work with the parents and the families, and improve them. That, to me, would be a great contribution.
That might require changing the culture, though.
And the city's culture.
Well, no, but there is a kind of, I don't know, Jim Wonderman, if you agree with this, there is a kind of difference in demographics here in terms of the way they view the world. There's a lot of, you know, social media is going to save the world as opposed to, you know, whatever has been saving the world or at least attempting to save the world.
Well, yeah, change is what San Francisco and this region have always been about, and I think the people who are here and are part of this movement, that, you know, they are change artists, and they're having an effect within their companies and within their sector, and a lot of them, like the one Dave, like the person Dave described, want to have an effect on society, in this case through the school system, which is obviously, you know, hugely important, and the challenge isn't that he's trying to do it and he can't get it done. The challenge is the institution has always been reluctant to accept new ideas and new approaches, and so that's not a new problem. I think that there are a lot of approaches that have been proposed by people in technology that are actually taking effect at schools and school systems around the region, and some here in San Francisco. And, you know, it's going to take a little time and patience. You know, there's a culture of speed to market, within the tech sector.
Jim Wonderman, we're right up on a hard break here, so I'm going to have to say goodbye to you, but I appreciate very much your being with us and getting your perspective. Jim Wonderman, again, is president and CEO of the Bay Area Council. We'll be back for more on this. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. There are now 1,700 technology companies based in San Francisco, and that's a 30% jump from 2 years ago. The tech boom has kept the unemployment rate well under the state average, and it's brought a lot of tax revenue to the city, but has it come at a cost? Critics say the trend and the accompanying high rents is shutting out artists in the middle class and threatening the very soul of the city of San Francisco. And San Francisco has long been embroiled in gentrification fights. How will it withstand the newest, biggest tech boom? We're talking about that with David Talbot, who has an article on this subject in San Francisco Magazine, newest issue called How Much Tech Can One City Take? And his recent book is Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love, which we discussed on Forum and which you can find in our archives. He's also founder and former editor-in-chief of Salon. We spoke with Jim Wunderman, president and CEO of the Bay Area Council, a regional business-sponsored public policy group based in San Francisco. And we're going to talk with you, our listeners. First, I wanted to read a web comment. Sarah says, there are many great things about this tech boom, but its impact to the housing market is not one of them. I've lived in San Francisco for many years now and love the city deeply. However, for the first time, I am seriously considering moving out because my partner and I can't find affordable housing, so we can move in together. We both have solid incomes, stable jobs, but we simply can't compete in this environment. Building a home together in San Francisco seems less feasible every day. The thought of leaving brings me to tears. Sad, but certainly not necessarily anomalous. And David Talbot, you were talking about the first boom, all that concern about Manhattanization and the tall buildings and so forth. This is different in a sense. It's more like what's happening to Manhattan, moving out to Brooklyn, and people like this, you know, finding different places that they can afford. In many cases, Oakland.
Absolutely. I think San Francisco in some ways is following that New York trend. We're becoming the Manhattan, the island, the elite island, where, you know, people who work in Manhattan's case on Wall Street, you know, inflate the economy and live in splendor in this great island. And, of course, young people, the service class, are being pushed out to the boroughs in New York. Same way here. You know, my house has become kind of a dormitory for young people. I raised two kids, two boys in San Francisco. They're 18 and 22. They're great kids, both very creative. They came up through the public schools. They went to School of the Arts, which is a wonderful public school in San Francisco. And yet they and their niece, who's now graduated and is a wonderful, you know, member of our family, now working for the city as an intern, they're looking more and more at Oakland as where they're going to end up living, even though, again, they love this city because it's more affordable, it's more open to young people and more open to artists. And there's a real ferment now in Oakland that because San Francisco, I think, is becoming more and more exclusive.
Well, in fact, I'm mentioning a bunch of things that are closing, like the Purple Onion, but also the Museum of Craft and Folk Art and Tosca, as I said earlier. All this seems to be a wave that's disturbing many San Franciscans and many of us who lived here in the Bay Area for many years. And talking about artists, we thought we'd bring Deborah Walker into this discussion before we go to your calls and emails. She's a land use arts activist, building commissioner in the city of San Francisco, and an artist, and ran for San Francisco Board of Supervisors back in 2010. Deborah, good to have you. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. You feel the city's losing its soul?
Well, I'm in the same neighborhood that KQED is in. It's historically arts and manufacturing, food processing, and it seems to be one of the areas, ground zero for, it was for the .com and it now is for the tech. So I think that the challenge is to maintain the very thing that brings these industries here, which is a highly inventive and creative population. We have, I don't know, over a half a dozen higher educational institutions focusing on the arts. We have had historically a large population of artists and creators in this city, and it does tend to bring these kind of industries here and then create at the end a threat to them because of how we do it.
And the threat has to do largely with housing, or it has to do with eclipsing essentially what the city has done innovatively and characteristically for artists? Yeah.
Well, I'll just give you the example of this later, the Twitter tax offer to the tech industry along Market Street. The effect was, even just discussing it, raised rents 25% along that corridor. And since it's been implemented, they've doubled. That doesn't just affect housing. It affects places and spaces for other types of businesses. It also, you know, really brings in a lot of good energy, I would say, but there is no mitigation of it. So there was no, like you were speaking earlier, of giving back to the community. There is no agreement about that. So you create a sort of a imbalance as to the other businesses and industries that actually make this a sustainable city. You know, the arts actually contribute to the tourist industry, which is always another big industry here. And the tourist industry doesn't benefit, or the businesses that support it, the restaurants, the art galleries, the theaters, they don't receive the same type of benefits because generally they're smaller. So it's a balancing act that I think we kind of fail at.
There's also the problem that these tax incentives are being given to businesses that are likely to be tech businesses, and that's an imbalance.
That's right.
It gives them an advantage for space, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And I've heard that from a lot of small businesses. We ran into that problem in the dot-com boom, which became the dot-com bust, because we actually displaced a lot of small businesses. They could not compete with the venture capitalized tech businesses or dot-com businesses, were driven out of town. Then when the bust happened, we had a lot of empty spaces. So it's not a sustainable model for anyone, really.
You know, Michael, I was going to, if I could, just speak up quickly for the tech elite. Because I
was just thinking, wouldn't you, other U.S. cities love to have this kind of problem?
I know. But, you know, because, look, the article and Deborah and all of us are raising these real, you know, warning signs about where the city's headed. But on the other hand, let's acknowledge that the tech, you know, consciousness, the tech culture, is inherently revolutionary in many ways. The people I hired at Salon were often more radical than I was. I mean, these people are by nature anti-authoritarian. They're very individualistic. They're creative. They're iconoclastic. I mean, to me, one of the great moments last year when I briefly went back to Salon and was there as CEO for a while was when our tech guys, the engineers themselves, said, you know what? We're a block or two away from the Occupy encampment down near the ferry building. They don't have Wi-Fi. Let's go hook them up. So they went down on their own time and hooked up the Occupy protesters and got them on the internet. And you know, so
I agree with that. And also I want to point out, this isn't, you know, bashing tech, because I think that a lot of tech partners with the arts community. I myself have worked with a few startups to, you know, sort of hash out some artistic, really good ideas that will help artists and the art community broadly. The issue is the policies that the governors or the, you know, the leaders and decision makers apply to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, Deborah Walker, again, land use arts activist and building commissioner in the city of San Francisco. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, all the techies are going to Burning Man. It's getting more expensive to go to Burning Man now.
Burning Man. We got to talk about that.
Well, let's go to your calls here, and let's begin with Greg. Greg joining us from Redwood City. Hi, Greg.
Hello.
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Yes. I myself have been working in the tech industry for a few years now, and I was actually recruited in. Just a new graduate, fresh out of college, and this particular tech company, which of course I won't say, came to my school, offered, you know, really good pay, really great benefits, and that was drove me to come here more than San Francisco itself. My only real encounter with San Francisco as a kid from the Midwest was from movies and books and things like that. So the culture here was completely different, and I'm still not really integrated into the culture, and I've been here for years. And I think that's really, like, a lot of this tech elite sort of thing. These workers are just skilled labor. We're just being kind of bust in, like, you know, Detroit during the automobile boom. So we're just trying to, like, sort ourselves out and get a feel for the city. And a lot of us, you know, we can't afford even to have these houses. I myself live with two roommates and, you know, not a great apartment. We all make good money. So we're trying to fit in. We're trying to make do, but we still don't really know our place, and we still don't know how to, like, develop the city with our own image added to it.
Yeah, there's a class. I agree with the caller, Michael. I mean, I think that was a great comment. There's a class system within the technological world, too. Let's you know, acknowledge that. We're not talking about sort of the workforce. And by the way, that workforce is overworked. I mean, one reason why this young man probably can't enjoy the city as much as he'd like to or feel integrated into it, he's probably working long, long hours. I mean, you see these Wi-Fi buses pick up these young workers and take them down to 101. That's just not because, you know, Google's being nice. It's so they can work during their commuting hours even. These people are cocooned in a work environment that stresses, you know, achievement and performance goals and, you know, work that a lot of us frankly, couldn't, you know, stomach. And so, you know, that's part of the cocooning of this technological world, too, away from the city, that these people are being worked to death.
And, Greg, thank you for your call. Let me go right to another caller. That's you, Richard. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
First of all, I'd like to make some interesting facts here. San Francisco per square mile is 17,000. Paris is 52,000 people per square mile, and the income here is about 43,000. The other thing I find really interesting is that, according to the San Francisco Apartment Association, 10% of the population of San Francisco is under $10,000, and the next 10% is about $60,000 to $70,000. I'm a retired school teacher and have lived here all my life, and the city is up for the highest bidder. It doesn't matter. Tosca's is going to go because Larry Flynn wants the building. Or the place down in the Mission where all those people who work in those restaurants, where all those guys and girls go down and spend $30 for lunch, is all going to go because it's going to be a city that's only going to be for the rich. I myself was a school teacher, and I can tell you that if a school teacher is making an average beginning salary of $50,000 at an average rent in San Francisco, $2,075, where is that person going to live? They're going to live in the highly dense area in the city, which is going to be Chinatown, according to the Real Estate Association. So the city is being sold. And one of the things that I really object to, personally, is that all the places that I went to as a kid and all the places that were existing out here in the Excelsior, which is the highest per capita mortgage foreclosures in the city, all those folks are gone. They're either lost their houses or they've gone. And the techers are downtown, and they're paying, making good money. I have no idea what they're making. I haven't looked it up. But they're doing very well, and they could care less. And as long and they don't tip worth the beans, and as long as they're happy and everybody's happy, the bottom line here is that what capitalism says is the city's up for sale, and nothing's going to stop it, and it's eventually just going to be, as a friend of mine once said, who moved to Arizona, by the way, it's going to be an expensive city with a beautiful view. And I want to thank you for that. Bye-bye.
Thank you for the call. Let me move along to another call. Greg, hi.
Hi. Two out of three Gregs. I was just calling in because I want to take issue with the way people associate stinginess with a political perspective. You guys both use the phrase libertarian stinginess. Now, I'm not a registered libertarian, but I am quite open to the viewpoints, and I'm on my way to see Gary Johnson. I actually speak at Cal Berkeley right now in my car.
Well, that's, we've got the man who used the phrase. So, David Talbot, you want to remark on that? Libertarian stinginess?
Yeah, look, there's lots of great things about the libertarian philosophy that I agree with. And, of course, San Francisco reflects a lot of that social tolerance and freedom. But, you know, to me, in my experience, the libertarian strain of the tech culture, the tech elite, is not one that encourages giving back, is not one that encourages working with unions, working with community groups, working with the public sphere, the public sector. And so I do think there's a stingy strain within the libertarian culture and specifically within the tech world. It's like, look, you know, you've got problems, you know, you're poor. You know, get a startup going. I mean, that's sort of the attitude among a lot of the people that I've known in that world.
Let me thank the caller, and we'll go next to you, Susan. You're on. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for the program, and I love the book, Season of the Witch. Thank you for that.
Oh, thank you.
Two very brief comments. It's wonderful that the tech people went and hooked up the Occupy people. Isn't that wonderful? But it, you know, that's not really a mark of caring about San Francisco or the larger global environment, because everybody I know who's working low-end jobs or has three or four jobs or is working in the restaurants has to move to Richmond, has to move way out. They have to commute somehow, which is getting increasingly expensive. What's the carbon footprint there? San Francisco is a wonderful city if you've got a ton of money. I've grown up here. I've fought four eviction battles, which were about quadrupling our rents, both for my artist space and my living space. I feel completely embattled, as do most of my friends who've grown up here. So it's wonderful that we have all the tech stuff, but let's not assume that things like hooking up Occupy are some indication of, you know, forward political thinking. Like the previous caller said, the city seems to be up for the highest bidder. Take a look at the party that happened in front of City Hall last week. That's a public space that our tax dollars support. That was completely cordoned off so Oracle could have a party.
Yeah, I do agree.
Thanks for the show.
I agree with
thanks
that. Look,
call.
By giving a nod to sort of the engineering workforce that hooked up Occupy, I'm not absolving the tech community of all its responsibilities, obviously. That's why I wrote the article. And by the way, I object to that too as well. When speaking of the city being up for the highest bidder, literally it is when Salesforce, even though Mark Benioff has been very generous in some ways to the city, when his company Salesforce or Oracle comes in and literally buys up whole city blocks, you know, creates huge traffic messes and inconvenience for the rest of the city so they can celebrate themselves, these big, you know, high-tech companies. And, you know, that happens around the convention center, Moscone. It happens around City Hall. And to me, that is kind of like, you know, gloating at the public expense.
Well, on the other hand, we were talking before about Twitter with Deborah Walker. Michael writes, interestingly, Twitter founder and chairman Jack Dorsey recently mentioned to a newspaper that he rides Muni every single day, specifically in order to stay in touch with the needs of everyday people, essential to being a good designer. He's also mentioned that Twitter and his other company, Square, are located in the city for this very same reason. In general, tech founders who've chosen to found a company in the city do so because they love it and appreciate it for the reasons we all do. Perhaps there's a way to get folks like this involved more directly in our local civic life here. It would be welcome. And more on our website of your comments. Lou writes, excellent topic and question. In 1995, I was working as a sound engineer for a popular, now unknown, local band. They had rehearsal studio along with about 200 other bands and creative artists in a large warehouse on 3rd Street. They all got thrown out when some dot-com startups took over the building. Now they no longer exist as a band, and we have no idea where the other 199 creatives ended up, and the creeps who took it over with the big bucks are gone too. I wonder what it is, what is in that 5-story block-style building now. Have we learned a lesson? The creative and artist types certainly have to go somewhere else in San Francisco. David writes on the website, displacing artists and longtime residents and the accompanying high rents, soul of the city. Sorry, dude, I think this article might be a reprint from 1999.
Yeah, same as it ever was, the Talking Heads one saying.
I'm a 23-year-old resident, Charles writes, of San Francisco's Noe Valley. Without the tech boom, we might be bemoaning the aging or even death of neighborhoods like Noe Valley. The two of you sound like you're being nostalgic for past times. Change does happen. Were either of you unemployed over the past recession? I was, and I'm not anymore. And part of my clientele is high tech. Economic development is good. Neighboring cities help provide more reasonably priced housing as well. Another listener writes, this is Nina, I've lived in San Francisco since 1974, went through the school system. I have a BA from San Francisco State, can't find a job, and I've been unemployed for 2 years. I don't want to leave San Francisco, but I can't find a job, and I don't have a tech background. I don't know what the problem is, but I feel left out. Miriam writes on our website, what about the role of unions? I'm sure they support the tech expansion to bring in more tax revenue. Tech expansion will also probably increase traffic congestion and pollution. What about the role of unions here, David Dalvin?
Well, I know the unions are supporting at least some of the unions. You know, Mayor Lee's initiative on the November ballot to shift taxes from payroll taxes, you know, to revenue taxes. You know, again, I think that's smart because if you want, you know, as the gentleman pointed out in one of the emails, you know, the city to have lower jobless rate as we do now, compared to the rest of the state, you've got to support those kind of initiatives. Unions have not been a major public force, though, I think, in this debate, by and large. And I think they're probably caught betwixt and between. On the one hand, you know, again, wanting the jobs. On the other hand, you know, realizing that the rising cost of living is pricing a lot of their members out. The Hotel and Restaurant Workers Union, I think, is, you know, played a really important role in the public life of the city. And, of course, their workers, their members are being, you know, very hard hit. And it's their workers, of course, who are serving this, you know, the high-paid workforce for the tech community.
Let me go to more calls, and we'll bring in Jim next. Jim, you're on.
Hi. I'm a native San Franciscan, and I've seen the city change over many, many years here. But I don't think what you guys are addressing is the income that these companies are bringing into. We're not Stockton, which is going bankrupt. And the city traditionally has been anti-business, and this seems like an anti-business conversation you're having. You can look down certain corridors and see shuttered businesses, and I believe there's a direct relationship between City Hall's attitude towards these evil businesses. So I think what we should think about is the money these companies are bringing in, and the city can do things to help the housing. For example, all new construction in San Francisco, 25% of new construction has to be going towards middle and low-income housing.
You know, I don't think, by the way, that City Hall has been anti-business. It's certainly not under Mayor Lee or Gavin Newsom before him, or Mayor Feinstein. I mean, those administrations have been very closely aligned with downtown business interests, or in the case of Mayor Lee, now the tech industry.
It's also true of Willie Brown and Frank Jordan, actually. I mean,
right.
They were certainly trying to enhance business.
Absolutely, Willie Brown and Frank Jordan. So, look, but I feel like the issue here is not whether San Francisco's anti-business. That's like saying you're anti the economy. Of course we're, for a prosperous tax base and business sector in the city, because that's the vital engine that drives everything. The question is whether that wealth is trickling down at a sufficient rate to benefit not just the elites at the top, but the people on the street. And to me, the real metaphor for that is the mid-market area, where you have Twitter, this very powerful high-engine social media company, literally in the clouds up on the 10th or 9th or 11th floor of that building. And down below, it's still, kind of no man's land. There are people nodding out, drugged out, crashed out in doorways. The cafes and the businesses there are not yet benefiting from the Twitter workforce, because the Twitter workforce is cocooned in that building. I would like to see, as we've been talking about earlier, that wealth start to permeate throughout the city and get redistributed, to use that word that the Republicans hate so much. We need more redistributionist policies in this city so that wealth is shared by many others.
Imagine what would happen if Barack Obama said that just the way you did in this election campaign. Let me take the caller and go to Mickey next. Mickey, thanks for waiting. Join us. Hi.
Hi. I read the article with great interest. It describes a lot of the processes I've seen over 18 years living in the Mission, and the pressure is pretty intense right now. I was quite surprised to see that the author brought in an anecdote from the Mission Minion. And I'm wondering if he could explain how he sees Mission Minion and the spiritual community there as somehow indicative of the decline of San Francisco's unique culture.
Well, I know that has been criticized by some of the participants in Mission Minion. I told an anecdote that was related to me by a woman who went to that particular service that one evening. She's not a regular member. In fact, she doesn't live in the city anymore, because she's been priced out of San Francisco after growing up here. But she was commenting that the people seemed very obsessed, despite the kind of religious or spiritual aspect of the evening, with business talk. And a lot of it was tech business talk. And when she said to them, do you ever think about giving back? She said there was a very awkward silence. Now, that was her experience, personal experience. I'm sure that there are many people who, participate in the Mission Minion who are very socially conscious and have given back. But she felt that the conversation just went dead at that point. And so that was the point that I was trying to make with that. I can't comment in general on the Mission Minion's membership or its commitment to social service.
Well, you mentioned the Mission Minion in the article, and you also mentioned names like Haas and Shorenstein and Fleischacker. I mean, when you look back at the history of San Francisco, it was mainly Jewish and Italian philanthropists who
built
the city. And to a great extent, they were mostly the sons of immigrants.
That's
and
right.
Came here with a different ethos than their children and grandchildren have.
Well, I think that was the point this woman was making, who is Jewish herself, that there is a great tradition in the Jewish culture of giving back, and a sense that, it's not just all about yourself, it's about your community. And, of course, we see that largesse, as I was saying earlier, throughout the city, and all the names I mentioned, right, Michael, tend to be Jewish.
Here's a listener named Linda who says, as you're assigning gifts brought by new communities, don't forget that gays displace working families with kids in the Castro, hippies displace blacks in the Haight, and speaking of knowing city history, those who live in the Fillmore, displacing a large black community that supplied music and arts, are starting to call it NOPA, or Lower Pacific Heights. another listener writes, I'm at a very moment trying to buy a home, a live workspace. I'm a 25-year-old renter in the San Francisco Bay Area and an artist, a disabled artist, for over 40 years working artist, and have been outbid on three houses already. And after 25 years in the Glenview neighborhood in Oakland, I'm pretty much forced out. I work for some of the wonderful, some of those wonderful companies, but I'm asking the same question. Why can't we give first dibs to those of us who have been here so long and built San Francisco into a creative mecca?
And maybe, Michael, we need – actually, this was raised by one of the people I was interviewing, the public school employee who couldn't find a house. She kept talking about people who swoop in and offer more above the asking price for a house. Some of those were tech people, but some of those are basically kind of real estate gamblers who are flipping those houses.
They're, again, the masters of the universe who are just – taking properties
and
then flipping them over, yeah. Sarah, join us. Sarah, you're on. Hi.
Hi. So you're basically telling my life story. I'm embattled on two fronts now. A flipper has just bought my house and is forcing me out after 12 years. But I just want to say, like, I'm an ex-tech worker who moved here in 2001 specifically because I like to do things backwards. Move in when things are down for the opportunity. And I'm interested in a different type of ROI. I'm a social entrepreneur, and I've started what I think is a really innovative, coincidentally, Jewish nonprofit here in San Francisco. But now that I'm being forced out to Oakland in 2 weeks, and three of my employees also live in Oakland, I'm starting to look at, well, should we just move the office to Oakland? I mean, this is silly. And I'm just wondering if San Francisco cares about innovation or if we care about money. And let's be real, because there are other types of innovation than just technology and finance.
A great comment. And that's essentially what I'm asking in this article in San Francisco Magazine. What do we want San Francisco to be, this great city that I write about in Season of the Witch, the city that through struggle and strife and dreams and craziness became the capital for not just progressive consciousness, but for thinking big, for creativity. And that's why the tech workforce has been attracted to the city. But we've got to, as a community, not it's not just City Hall, but as a community, people with wealth, unions, community organizations come together and create a city that's livable for all of us.
On that note, and just one quick email here from Jim, who says, could we just forget about creating a utopia and pave the streets?
I'd start there.
Good to have you, David. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Michael.
David Talbot's book, by the way, is Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. And he wrote the article, How Much Tech in One City Take, in San Francisco Magazine. You can find it on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And you can continue the discussion that way. Also, thanks to Jim Wunderman and Deborah Walker, and thanks to you, our listeners. Our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Amanda Stupai. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.